Bob, yes it is, yes it is. I'm an alcoholic, I'm an alcoholic. Yes I am, yes I am. This is great. I love the laughter. Love the laughter in this program. It's a real special. Thank you, Rita. Rita and I have, as she said, a special relationship. It goes back a number of years, and it's great what we've learned, or what I've learned as a result of that. So it's a real privilege to be here tonight to talk at an Al-Anon convention. I think that's a real honor for me. My name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 1st, 1975, and I'm very grateful for that. I thought that I would bring you a little bit of outside stuff before I got it really into my talk, and I want to tell you about the Alcoholic Creed. The Alcoholic Creed is, I may not be very important, but I'm all I ever think about. And I don't want to go too far without telling you a little bit about an Al-Anon. And I was in a meeting not too long ago, and there was a fellow there, and it was actually a workshop, and he was talking about, he was in Alcoholics Anonymous, he was an AA and alcoholic, and he had married an Al-Anon. And they had been married about a year, he said. And he said one morning they were sitting at the breakfast table, and she looked over at him and said, you know, we have at least one thing in common. And he said, oh, really, what's that? And she said, we both love you. So it wasn't very long after I was in the program that I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I was in a drugstore, and they had one of these wire racks with the books on them, and I noticed that one of them was called The Booth Battle, so I decided that I'd take a look at it. And I don't remember anything about the book, except in the fly leaf of this book was a poem. And I've been carrying it around ever since, and that's been a lot of years, but I want to share it with you because it must have been written by an Al-Anon. It says, there must be something the matter with him, because he would not be acting as he does unless there was. Therefore, he is acting the way he is because there is something the matter with him. He does not think there is anything the matter with him, because one of the things that is the matter with him is that he does not think there is anything the matter with him. And this is the true Al-Anon part here. Says, therefore, we have to help him realize that the fact that he does not think there's anything the matter with him is one of the things that is the matter with him. My journey in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous started on December 31st, 1974. And it was a day pretty much like many days had been in my life at that point. I woke up in the morning, had a little coffee, and began to drink. And it somehow I felt that if I had coffee, it made it okay, that you know, there was a national drink. And what didn't occur to me was that most people don't drink vodka on the rocks at 7:30 in the morning. And that was the way that my life had gotten to. And I don't remember exactly what time I started, but how long am I supposed to talk? As long as I want. Did everybody have? Did anyone bring their bedroll? Oh, a big clock. Is it set? Any rate, it's great to be here. And that day was pretty much the way that all day started for me at that period of my life. And I got up, and we talk a lot about keeping it simple in this program, and it was really simple for me at that time. I wasn't working. I get up and I drink, and you know, the day just sort of became a blur for me. I was married at the time, and my wife was working, and she came home for lunch, and we began to have one of those arguments, you know, the kind of arguments that by the time it's over, nobody ever understood what you started to argue about to begin with, and you say every lousy, dirty, rotten thing you can think of about each other. And I guess it just wore her out, because she never even went back to work that day. But I want to tell you a little bit, I think in the interest of honesty, I want to tell you why she was working. This was December of 74, and I had pretty well gone broke and decided that I might as well declare bankruptcy. So we made the list of all the people that I had owed money to, and on this list was this couple that owned this dress shop. And I didn't think it was real fair to put them on the list, because I had gone and bought her a bunch of stuff and charged it and hadn't paid for it. So I called a meeting with them. So I met with this couple and told them about all the financial problems and how it just didn't look like I was going to make it. But I offered her to go to work for them to pay off the clothes that I had bought her back in August of that year. And to show you what, that's how sick I was, but to show you what a sick Al-Anon she was, she took the job. So at any rate, that's what was going on in our house at that time. And I described myself, I labeled myself as a go-getter during that time. I'd make sure she got up, got to work on time, then at the end of the day, I'd go get her. And so it was kind of tenuous around our place. At any rate, that night, I went out to have a drink, which was a little bit different for me. I was sort of a home drinker and had only been in Dallas for about a year, and so I didn't know a lot of people, and so I drank at home. And I came back, and I passed out on the couch. And her story is that she said she looked at me, and I had that alcoholic look, that clenched jaw and the twitching eyelids and that mixture of rage and terror, and said something like, "God, can't you see we're destroying each other?" And it wasn't even a prayer, apparently. But at any rate, eventually I woke up, and this was New Year's Eve now. It was about 7:30, 8 o'clock, and I went upstairs, and I sat down, and I started to cry. And that was, I believe, my moment in time. That was my truth. That was the time that I began to surrender, although I wouldn't have had any idea about that word or about what it meant. But she said, I guess I said to her, "Can't you see I'm asking for help?" And that was as honest as I had ever been up to that point. And she said, "I don't know how to help you." So I said, "Let's call AA." And I think this is probably true for Al-Anons as it is for alcoholics. But I don't believe there's ever any such thing as a wasted 12-step call. I don't think there's ever a time when an effort to carry the message goes unheeded, because some point, and I base this on my own personal experience, at some point in my life, someone had brought me Alcoholics Anonymous. They had 12-stepped me. They had been my big book. They had been whatever word you want to use. I have no idea who it was. I have no recollection of it. I don't remember anything about it. Don't know who was involved. All I know is that when it became my turn to get sober, I knew whoever it was had planted the seed of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. So that night, I called AA. And they came, got us, and took us to a meeting. And that was the beginning of my journey. And what happened at that meeting for me is what happens, I think, for so many of us. But whether you're alcoholic or Al-Anon, there is something that happens at the first meeting for so many of us that never dies, that always lives. And I think the way I describe it is that I received the silent message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it wasn't what anybody said, and it wasn't what anybody did. It was just that aura of what goes on here. It was a New Year's Eve party, and people were kind of dressed up, and they were laughing and having a good time. And whatever it was, touched me. Whatever it was, touched me. And so I think that night I got the silent message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The next morning, I had my second moment in time. And I was sitting in bed, and I was afraid I was going to drink, because that's what I always did. Except something was different for me that morning. I didn't want to drink. And that's the first morning I've remembered in years and years that I just didn't want to drink. But I was so afraid, because it was a pattern. It was a real habit for me. And all of a sudden, the phone rang. And it was one of the guys that had come pick me up the night before. And his name is Bill. He's still here. And he said, "Bob, how are you doing?" I said, "I'm okay." And he said, "Have you had a drink yet?" And I often wondered how he knew to ask me that question. But but he knew. And I said, "No, I haven't had a drink yet." And he said, "Well, why don't you not drink today? And I'll pick you up tonight, 7:30, and we'll go to a meeting." I said, "Okay." And that was my first actual meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've not had a drink since, and I'm very grateful for that. And I'm very grateful to Bill for doing that. Now, there are lots of possible explanations for that phone call, but for me, there's only one explanation, And that was God working through Bill to make it possible for me to do the one thing that is necessary to make it in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is to not drink for 24 hours. And that's the only thing that we have to do. But we have to do that. And that made it possible for me to do that. So that began my journey in this program. I want to tell you, though, what I think began my journey towards and into alcoholism. When I was 3 or 4 years old, I grew up in a small town, Ohio, and when I was 3 or 4, my memory is what I'm about to tell you. What actually happened, I have no idea. And my folks don't have any recollection of it. But my memory is that I was out in my front yard. There's another little kid there, about 3 or 4, and my folks were there, and there were a bunch of other people there. And it was just one of those days in a small town. And this other kid and I got in a fight. Well, I chickened out. And I knew right then, I don't know where I'm, what this was, the feelings, and how much of it was words in my head, but I knew right then that I was not okay. I knew that only cowards chickened out. I knew that you're supposed to stand up and fight like a man. I knew all that stuff. Now, how much of it I knew intellectually and how much I just knew intuitively, I can't tell you. But I knew that what I had done was bad. And so I began that day to have all those feelings that grew through the years and brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous. The feelings of fear, the feelings of guilt, the feelings of remorse, all of those feelings that made me feel less than you or less than anyone. But because God is gracious and merciful, he takes care of potential alcoholics, that experience did not end with the fight. What happened was, is the other kid got up and took off down the sidewalk. I guess he figured he was in my yard and he was going to get in trouble. Well, that gave me the opportunity that I needed. I didn't realize it at the time, but what I did is I got up and took off after him. Now, I didn't want to catch him. You know, I'd had all of him I needed for one morning. But I wanted my folks to think, and all the other people who were there in the yard, that I'd run him off. That began my charade. And I lived that charade from that day to some degree until this day, but certainly until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous and began to understand. And it wasn't until a few years into the program that I was reading the Big Book and I found my story in one sentence in the Big Book. The details are not there, but everything else is there. It says, he wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but he knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. And that is my story. And from that very moment, when I was 3 or 4 years old, I wanted to enjoy that reputation, and I wanted my folks to think that I'd run this kid off. But the problem was always the same from that day on. As I ran down the sidewalk after him, I knew the truth. I knew that I didn't deserve that reputation. My way of dealing with that, by the way, as you know, I think when we have those kinds of experiences, different people deal with them different ways. And my way of dealing with it was to become an overachiever. So I became an overachiever. I sought that certain reputation, and I got it. And I got it at every stage of my life. Now, as I like to say, when you have the underlying feeling that you're really not okay, then, I don't know about you, but I tended to draw occasional experiences to me which confirmed, yes, Bob, you're really not okay. So at the same time that I was being elected president of all these things and playing on basketball teams and all that kind of stuff and realizing or believing that if you really knew me, you'd never let me do any of that stuff, I became a very good speller. And I was in the sixth grade, and I was I was in the finals. It was myself and one other kid. And I grew up in this small town that had a small town radio station, and they do things like put things in the paper about kids and stuff like that. So they decided that they were going to tape this spelling bee championship. Well, I was absolutely petrified at the idea of getting on the radio. If somebody had once told me, you know, it won't be too long, you're going to be talking to several hundred people, I would have had apoplexy. But at any rate, I was scared to death. So they all got it. They got us all out into this alcove, and it was Central Elementary School in my hometown. And I can even remember how the alcove was shaped. And this was in the days of the reel-to-reel kind of tapes. So we got out there, and all the teachers were there, and then this other kid was there, and the moderator was there. And so he sticks that microphone in my face and probably said, "What is your name?" And I threw up all over him, the microphone, everything. Well, now this was a real small town. It wasn't so small that the sign coming in and the sign leaving the town were back to back, but it was pretty small. And I don't think either the technology wasn't there or they just couldn't afford an eraser for their tape. So at 4 o'clock that afternoon, they played the whole thing on the radio, my throw up and everything else. So I tended to occasionally have those experiences that confirm for me, yes, Bob, you really aren't okay. But I went through life, and I had lots of good things happen to me. And if you had been in my town and watched me, you would have picked me as the most likely to succeed, or you certainly would pick me as among the group most likely to succeed, because that was a charade that I portrayed. But what happened to me is, as I would gain momentum in my reputation, my feelings would also gain momentum, and the feelings of not being worthy, and the feelings of guilt, and the feelings of remorse, and the feelings of cowardice, and all those things would gain momentum too. And what happened is I found myself in law school, and I was an excellent student in law school. I was near the top of my class, and I was on law review. I had this problem, though. Well, and I had, as a result of that, developed a certain reputation as a law student. The problem that I had was that I had this fear that I could not make it as a lawyer. And I knew that. That was a fear, as I understand today. But at the time, that was a certainty. I knew absolutely that I couldn't make it as a lawyer, and it didn't make any difference if I was first in the class, second in the class, or last in the class. This set in motion something that I think is extremely wasteful for people like myself. What I did with that fear is I became clever enough to dance around the experience that I was afraid of so that I didn't have to have the experience. And the way I did that was real simple. I didn't practice law. Now, I didn't ever have to deal with the fear of whether I could make it or not as a lawyer. So I graduated from law school in June of 1963, and in November of 1977, I got the Texas bar ticket. That's 14 years, for those of you who aren't good at math. And in the interim period, I didn't do anything about that career. I did what I call wandered around in the wilderness, which is pretty much what I did. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, which was a little earlier than that, my life was a zero. At least that's how I believed it. As a matter of fact, I think that what drove me into Alcoholics Anonymous was not so much my drinking, but how I felt about it. And not even how I felt about my drinking, but how I felt about my life. I had been given everything. We were near the top of the socioeconomic class in this small town. And I just, I had a car when I was old enough to drive and all that sort of thing. And I had a wonderful education. I went to Duke undergraduate, went to Georgetown Law School. I did well everywhere I went. And yet, at the age of 36 and a half, I was a zero. I had no career. I was broke. Every relationship I had was damaged. And so I think what drove me in here is that I was just sad. I was just sad at where my life had come. And I was so sad that I guess I became willing to try to do something about it. And someone had suggested Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess. So that's how I ended up here. After I got here, I like to tell my story through the eyes of my sponsors. I've had three sponsors, four. Sponsors. And my first sponsor was a man named Shep, whose wife, Nancy, is a longtime Al-Anon here in the Dallas area and a wonderful friend. Shep is now dead, but he left me some legacies that will always serve me. And that's been my experience with all of my sponsors. They leave me things that will always serve me if I will take them. And Shep taught me a little phrase, let it unfold. Let it unfold. And that was his real legacy to me. And now when he first taught me that, I had no clue what he was talking about. What he really meant was, Bob, if you'll just let life happen and then you respond as life happens, you'll be okay. It's when you force things that you get into trouble. Now, that was a tough concept for me because I knew I was right. And when you know you're right, it's real hard to let it unfold. You ever try to take the third step on something you know you're right about? That's a real tough order. So for a long time, I never really did understand it. I never forgot it. I just never understood it. And then over a period of time in the program, I began to get a better idea of the concept of let it unfold. And today, my day starts every morning with asking God to help me let today unfold and not be upset by the delays, diversions, and distractions. And I don't know about your days, but my days are full of delays, diversions, and distractions. That's just the way life is. Even if I'm not doing anything, it's full of that. And so that idea of let it unfold helps me greatly on a daily basis. And this program has been so good to me that about 2 years ago I bought a boat, which I have out at Lake Louisville. And, you know, you put a name on the back of your boat. It's one of the little things boat people do. And I couldn't figure out a name, and all of a sudden, the name came to me. And the name of my boat is Let It Unfold. And people wonder what that's all about. I'll tell them if they're interested. But the fact is that that idea is the idea that propels my life today. That is, to me, the dominant theme of my life is to let life unfold and to practice these principles in responding to life as it comes to me. Another thing that Chep taught me through some of the people that raised me, there was a guy named Nip, and Nip nipped a lot. And a matter of fact, Nip nipped after he was sober for a while, he would nip a little. And so he had a lot of desire chips. But he finally got sober. And he had been sober for several years, and it's funny how some of these things stand out. I can tell you where I was sitting the morning that he made the statement. But he was making a talk at the Alpha Group on Sunday morning one morning, and he said that the difference between the times that he had not made it in the program and this time was that he had been taught and learned habits consistent with sobriety. And that's the other legacy that Shep and the people that raised me left with me. They taught me habits consistent with sobriety. Now, most of us know that habits consistent with sobriety for the alcoholic include prayer and meditation in the morning, going to meetings, calling your sponsor, reading the big book, all the simple things. And I'd like to also point out that as far as I know, now I'm almost 20 years sober. I'm January 1st, 75. And today, the habits consistent with sobriety are exactly the same as they were in January of 1975. There is not one shred of difference. We use lots of different words today. We have lots of different ideas. We have lots of different concepts. But there is no, for me, there is not one difference between the habits that were consistent with my sobriety then and the habits that are consistent with my sobriety today. This little phrase, habits consistent with, has been something also that I got out of those early years in the program. Because as I've come through life, I have learned that there are other areas of my life that didn't work too well. Not just my drinking. And so I have been brought to the point where I was willing to learn habits consistent with being an absentee father. My kids live out in California. I have learned to habits consistent with financial responsibility. That was a real tough one for me because I thought all of the economic principles were unnecessary. Such things as you're better off if you don't spend more than you make. Didn't make any sense to me at all. I have an IRS principle that I used to operate on. This is not one of the principles embodied in our 12 steps. But my IRS principle is if you can't pay, don't file. And as you can see, probably by the time I got into this program, my life was unmanageable. I am a good example of page 52 in the big book, which lists, well, as a matter of fact, I'm going to read them to you. It lists what are called the bedevilments, and it basically describes my life as it was when I came in. It says, we were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution to these bedevilments. Now, I think these bedevilments accurately describe my life when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. But the interesting thing about the difference between my ideas and the ideas expressed in this book is if you had asked me, how's your life, Bob, I would have started telling you that it's not very good, and you would have said, why? And I would have been listing all of the things externally that were not working for me. And when I look at these bedevilments, there are 8 of them. 6 of them are inside jobs. 6 of them are, how are you doing inside, Bob? And that's where I was so hurting so badly, I didn't understand that. As a matter of fact, when I got here, I started to hear about the 4-step. Some of you may have heard about the 4-step. And if you're anything like me, you heard about it the first day. And the first thing you heard about it is, God, if there's any way in the world that you can avoid doing the 4-step, do it. So I pretty quickly figured out that I wasn't going to be able to avoid it. So what I decided is I would have a selective 4-step. And the selective thing that I was sure that I would never tell was the story that I told you about chickening out of that fight. I was so embarrassed and so humiliated by that experience that I never was ever going to share it with anyone. But the strength and power of this program is such that it brought me not only to share it in the 4th and 5th step, but now I share it from the podium, and almost always, frequently when I talk, someone in the audience has had a similar experience about chickening out of a fight or feeling that way as a result of that kind of early experience. The 4-step thing, as a matter of fact, I think the person who said it is in the room today. I'm going to say it from the standpoint of a real old-timer who's in the program, who says, I've been around so long that my 4-step is rated PG. And I got that from someone here. But at any rate, my second sponsor, his name was Bob White. And Bob was a main man for me. He was just an absolute wonderful guy. And he had he had a lot of charisma in his own right, but he also had something a little special on a one-on-one, at least he did for me. So there was a time in my program that my career wasn't doing too well. As a matter of fact, for some time in the program, my career wasn't doing too well. And one day, I decided that I needed to do a 4-step on my career. And Bob was my sponsor at the time, and I asked him if he would be willing to hear my 5th step. So I wrote this 4-step that said something like, started with something like, Dear God, why is my career so screwed up? Well, I went down to see him, and we did the 5th step, and
this is the end of side 1. Turn your cassette over and continue to play on the other side. Thank you.